I'm so glad all of you could make it here today. As always, it's such an honor for us to have Dr. Kenneth Cook with us. For those unfamiliar with me, my name is Mary Angela DeGrazia DiTucci. I should shorten that name because that takes up a minute just to say my name. I'm a longtime patient with pseudo-obstruction that's progressed to include gastroparesis, reflux, achalasia, diffuse esophageal spasm. I have a host of other medical problems. Very interesting adventure. I also volunteer for AGMD. AGMD is a nonprofit international organization, and it serves as an integral educational resource for GI motility disorders. And it also functions as an important clearinghouse for members of the medical, scientific, and nutritional communities. And of course, it provides a form of support for patients and their families suffering from digestive motility disorders. During the first part of the program, we ask that you hold off on your questions because I know we got quite a few. And then we have the second part that's reserved specifically for that. Dr. Cook is a professor of medicine, the section of gastroenterology and hepatology at Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center. He has a career-long interest in understanding the pathophysiological mechanisms of nausea and gastroparesis. Dr. Cook, again, we're so honored to have you here today. And so the area that we're going to be focusing on is gastroparesis and functional dyspepsia. Are they the same or are they different? And I think maybe to start off with, a lot of patients may not know they're beginning their journey with gastroparesis. So if you can give like a little bit of a description of gastroparesis and then a functional dyspepsia, and then you can take it from there. How's that sound?
All right. That's perfect. That's perfect, Angela. Thank you very much. And good morning, everybody. So we kind of thought this topic, it's timely for a recent publication that's come out from our gastroparesis clinical research consortium. And it's always timely to talk about these two words because you know, these are words that doctors use, and you might be interested in what we think the definitions of these words are, because they're both diagnoses, and they've been very, to me, confusing over the years for reasons which we'll get into. So, for instance, gastroparesis refers to a condition. It's a condition of, you know, a weak stomach that doesn't empty normally. And that's it. We say that the stomach does not empty normally in the absence of a mechanical obstruction, you know, like a cancer or an ulcer or something that has scarred the stomach so it can't empty. A definition doesn't really include the symptoms. And the symptoms, as many of you know, are not much appetite, early satiety, filling up quickly. When food is in the stomach, there can be more nausea. The nausea can be so bad that there's vomiting of chewed food. There could be some bloating. There can be some pain, the discomfort, surely, and pain. So we got it. But now, so what's functional dyspepsia? I mean, those two words are like pure descriptive, you know, one is functional, which has no meaning to me, and one is dyspepsia, which has no meaning to patients and is confusing to doctors. Yet that word, that functional dyspepsia, you might have heard it, in your own case. You might have heard it somewhere. You might have read about it. And so, you know, I'm going to take a specialist, a gastroenterologist definition of functional dyspepsia. And it is a set of symptoms I'm going to describe in a moment. But it's those symptoms in the absence of like an ulcer, in the absence of H. pylori, the infection, in the absence of a tumor or any kind of, you know, blood work is normal. But the patient with functional dyspepsia has these symptoms. They fill up right away after they eat. They have like early satiety. They have various amounts of nausea. They can have vomiting. Vomiting can be food. They can have discomfort of various kinds. They can have bloating. But they have normal gastric emptying. So they basically have the same symptoms as those patients with gastroparesis. So, but they have normal emptying. And so that's led to the idea, well, so the symptoms, where are they from? And, you know, the word functional gets stuck on there, like we don't know where they come from. And for many years, we haven't known where they come from. But we're getting better at it, I think. And so this, many, many more people have functional dyspepsia than have gastroparesis. Like in my own clinic, if I see patients with those symptoms I just described, and if I saw 10 patients and I sent them all for a gastric emptying study, three would have delayed emptying. And seven, you know, would be just as sick, almost the same symptoms, but their emptying is normal. So what that should tell us is that, you know, the symptoms that we associate with gastroparesis and with FD, they're clearly not dependent, totally, at least, on the rate of gastric emptying. It's same symptoms, but one group empties slowly. And that's where we've been for a lot of years. And we've tried to figure out how to treat the gastroparetics. And we then try to figure out how to treat the FD patients. And they're somewhat different because, you know, the functional bit implies there's some stress or there's some depression and you know, drugs for stress and depression are sometimes given, you know, in the FD, but they're also given for the GP patients. So here's what's kind of new. And so the NIH, you know, with this gastroparesis research consortium, we've entered many hundreds of patients who have gastroparesis into a registry. But 20% of the people, maybe almost 25% of those who entered actually had normal emptying. So we knew we had a bit of a comparison group built in. And so we recently did a study where it was over 200 patients with gastroparesis, let's call it at week zero or week one, and we simply repeated the gastric emptying study at week 48. Okay, you just got it. You know, your doctors, the PIs, they worked, they tried to get you feeling better. But it's whatever happened at 48 weeks, the gastric emptying study is repeated. And I guess the surprise finding, you'd say, is this. At the 48 week period, 40% of the patients now had normal gastric emptying. 40% had normal emptying. But when you checked the symptoms with our standard questionnaire, whether you had a normal emptying or you remained delayed emptying, the symptoms were basically the same. So this is pretty strong evidence that, you know, it's not the rate of emptying. The rate of emptying is not the key factor driving the symptoms. And on the other hand, those patients who had, and it was over 100, who had normal gastric emptying at week zero or week one, they underwent another gastric emptying at 48 weeks. And about 30% of those folks were now delayed. There was a switching back and forth. And just like the gastroparesis group, if you looked at their symptoms at baseline or week zero and 48 weeks, there really wasn't much change. So this is a new study. It begins to let us know that the symptoms are not really, really driven by the rate of gastric emptying. So where are these symptoms coming from? What problems do they share? What problems does the patient with gastroparesis and functional dyspepsia, what physiology do they share? Well, here's one, and there's about three, but first of all, both groups, thanks to some biopsy studies and patients being willing to undergo biopsies of their stomach, both groups have a loss, depletion of the pacemaker cells. And you all know now the pacemaker cells are the ICCs, or the interstitial cells of Cajal. Those are the cells that give the stomach rhythm. Without rhythm, the heart isn't much good. Without rhythm, your stomach isn't much good. The normal rhythm of the stomach is 3 cycles per minute. And as you begin to be depleted of the rhythm cells, you get into bad rhythms. It's a lot like cardiology. You get into dysrhythmias. We call them tachygastrias, bradygastrias. There can be conduction defects. There can be ectopic foci. And so really the stomach is quite electrical. I wrote an editorial once called "The Electrifying Stomach." It's an electrifying organ, isn't it? Now, we want it to behave. We don't want it to be too electric, but it is electric. And these pacemaker cells then coordinate the muscle. The muscle wants to be wild. Muscle wants to contract all the time. And the pacemaker cells coordinate contractions to allow for the normal peristaltic waves that mix and empty our food. So it's very interesting that the both patients with FD and normal emptying and those with gastroparesis have loss of ICCs. Now the gastroparetic patients have more of a loss, but they both have these dysrhythmias, and we think dysrhythmias will interfere with contractions and emptying. And dysrhythmias, we've also known from the past studies that they are associated with like the nausea of motion sickness, the nausea of the nausea of pregnancy. So we'd like to have more approach to bad rhythms and correct it with drugs or whatever, but both groups have that problem. It looks like on these biopsies, like the nerves are mostly intact and the smooth muscle is intact. So the thought is becoming these are problems of the pacemaker cells creating some havoc after we eat. And that's one point. The second point is both gastroparetics and people with functional dyspepsia have been shown by studies, been shown this, that in response to a meal or a balloon distension, or what we call it a water load satiety test, to various stimuli to distend the stomach, patients with gastroparesis and FD, their stomachs don't distend very well. In one of our recent studies, it's almost 25% of our patients with gastroparesis and the same amount, basically, in those with functional dyspepsia, they felt completely full and they were nauseated after consuming about 8 ounces of water. They had to consume that water over a 5-minute, well, they were told you have 5 minutes to drink till you're completely full. 5 minutes till you're completely full. So they are sipping away, drinking away, and at the end of 5 minutes, about 25% of these patients were totally full. Many had nausea, discomfort, and they were full at a volume of about 8 ounces. And I don't know, you know, if you've seen an 8 ounce cup recently, that's not very much. And the average healthy person drinks about 20 ounces in 5 minutes and says, I'm full. And they're full, but otherwise comfortable. Patients with FD and with the gastroparesis patients, they are not only full at that volume, but they have the other symptoms or brought on. So we think that another way to get symptoms generated, the other driver of symptoms is that these patients have stomachs that do not relax. They do not accommodate a normal volume, and that itself, you know, can set off either dysrhythmias or stretch receptors that create symptoms. And of course, a lot of patients with gastroparesis and FD, they've learned this over the years. They know that they must consume small amounts frequently. If they overdistend their stomach by overeating too much volume, you create more symptoms. So both groups have this problem. And so I think that's what we're learning that make these two disorders, you know, very, you might say, similar, or they are, we often say they're very close along a continuum of nerve, let's call it neuromuscular disorders. The problem of rhythm can be on a continuum. And the problem of the stomach relaxing, you know, is that another problem? There are different nerves that create relaxation for the stomach, and perhaps they're not working properly. So those are two areas where the disorders are very similar from pathophysiology, and I think that's where we'll see efforts in the future to control some of those aspects? Can we modulate those so there's better rhythm and there's better relaxation? So Mary Angela, should I take a little break there? Do you want to, is there any questions at that part in my compare and contrast?
Marie from Massachusetts had posed this question and wanted you to elaborate on the two subtypes of functional dyspepsia. Is one or the other more closely associated with gastroparesis?
Yeah. Okay. It's a great question because under the Rome, so there's quite a large book, two volumes now, that goes through everything from esophagus, you know, to the anal rectum, looking at all these different organs and different symptoms, and tries to classify neuromuscular, dysfunction across the GI tract. It's a big system, as you know, and many people have more than one problem. So we're focused here on the stomach, and under the functional dyspepsia group, and that would assume you've had an endoscopy, and the endoscopy is normal, and that, you know, it's not a gallbladder problem, it's not irritable bowel problem. But you are still with symptoms by questionnaires and other modalities. Two, even three subtypes of functional dyspepsia are talked about. The most common, and it may be 80% of the functional dyspepsia people, the term that you'll hear perhaps is the postprandial distress symptoms, PDS, postprandial distress. And this is a nod to the fact that most patients with a stomach problem, they might feel okay if they don't eat. Yeah, if they don't eat, they feel okay. But when they start to swallow food and the food starts to enter the stomach, then the trouble begins. And so under postprandial distress syndrome or symptoms, you'll see things like early satiation, which is that early filling, of prolonged fullness. There can be some discomfort. It's been modified a little bit. You can add some nausea in there. So again, it's almost like the same grouping of nonspecific symptoms that we have with gastroparesis. And the other main subgroup under FD is called epigastric pain syndrome, epigastric pain. And this is to identify those patients who say, you know, it's not that I'm so full. It's not that I fill up right away. It's that I'm in pain. And the pain is right there in the epigastrium, right there in the upper mid abdomen. And it's a pain that's the number one problem. And yet there's a normal endoscopy. Gallbladder's okay. It's not irritable bowel. And those are the two major subtypes of FD. But like I say, in my practice, I just don't see that many of those. They really are the postprandial distress symptoms, which to me are really the very same symptoms that we've associated with delayed gastric emptying. Does that help? I hope that kind of sorts that out. But
yes,
that
in fact,
that's the way the doctors separated out. And you know, so like Mary Angela and I were talking the other day, you know, when a patient goes in, you know, what the doctor wants to hear is really how you feel, you know, after you eat. One of my simplest questions is, well, tell me how you feel after you eat. Because guess what? You're supposed to feel good. End of story. Eating, you're supposed to feel good. And basically, well, I feel bad. And then, you know, well, in what way do you feel bad? You know, is it you can't swallow? Is it you have heartburn? Is it once the food hits the stomach, quote unquote, you know, that's when you start feeling full, nauseated, pain, you see what I mean? And so this is where the doctors begin to collect what symptoms are really the bothersome ones.
We also got a question from Karen from Connecticut. And she asked, what is there, meaning the gastroparesis and functional dyspepsia, relationship to visceral hypersensitivity in esophageal spasms?
Yeah, so, you know, for visceral hypersensitivity, this is another, you know, sort of somewhat confusing term. Because if you recall, you know, when food goes into a normal stomach, the sensations are pleasant. They are good sensations. They're gradually, you fill up, you feel pleasantly full, you feel comfortable. So in contrast, if you have FD or you have gastroparesis, that's not true. As the food goes down, you begin to feel uncomfortable. So is that visceral hypersensitivity, or is that just the response, you know, to a stomach that doesn't relax? There's a problem of capacity, accommodation, a problem of rhythm. And because it's a abnormality, it's a dysfunction, you know, you become aware of it. You become aware of it because there are nerves in your stomach, vagus, afferent nerves, that carry messages to your brain every moment. Most people are quite aware of their stomach every moment. Right now, I could tell you my stomach is, let's see, it's comfortable. Maybe it's 50% full because I've been snacking. So we are sensitive to our stomach in general. And so to define hypersensitivity, you know, you'd almost have to do a test. Like my patients, I have other patients who drink, 20 ounces, and they drink a lot, but at 20 ounces, they also begin to get symptoms. Others get it at, 8 ounces. So is it a hypersensitivity or is it a stretch problem? So this is pretty a little bit thorny problems to sort out. Actually, the hypersensitivity angle, but certainly we'll pick a drug. We think, well, you seem to be sensitive to that meal, that distension, and that's when we start pulling out drugs like Elavil, those types of tricyclics to try to dampen quote unquote sensitivity. Was there a question about esophageal spasm as well in there?
Yes.
Yeah.
So they wanted to know the relationship between that and the esophageal spasms.
Yeah. So if somebody had, trouble with chest pain and dysphagia, I would separate that from the symptoms of functional dyspepsia or the symptoms associated with gastroparesis, the ones we just talked about, the early satiety and nausea and so on. So in my mind, such a patient would have two problems. There's an esophageal spasm problem and there's a gastric neuromuscular problem. The only thing that might tie them together would be acid reflux. Acid reflux could get tied up in here as well. And in some patients who have acid reflux, the acid stimulates esophageal spasm. And acid reflux or GERD would be very common, in my view, in my experience, with patients who have FD and gastroparesis. That's why most such patients are on some kind of acid suppression. So anyway, sometimes acid reflux can cause esophageal spasm, and that might link the two.
So I'm going to go back to Marie from Massachusetts. Marie, are you on this call?
Okay, cool. Hey, so I was curious as to whether visceral hypersensitivity can be distinguished from epigastric pain syndrome, and if so, how?
Yeah, well, I think, so let's talk about the epigastric pain for a moment, because let's talk about your question first, just to distinguish it. So I suppose if I was going to try to see about this, I would do this water load satiety test that we have. We do it as part of recording the electrogastrogram or gastric electrical activity, but if you were comfortable in your chair and you had this 5 minutes to drink till you're completely full, and you get that job done, and as your stomach is filling, you say, wait a minute, that's my pain. My pain is coming on. And let's say you drank the normal amount of water, 20 ounces. You see, you drank the normal amount, your stomach relaxed to accommodate that 20 ounces, and it brought on pain. So that might be a hypersensitivity person to me. Whereas in contrast, what if you drank only, like I said, maybe 8 ounces? And you say, okay, I can't take it anymore. That pain is there, I'm done. I say, wow, you didn't even stretch your stomach very much. Your stomach didn't relax. I'd probably call that a problem of stomach relaxation. And you hurt because your stomach didn't relax. not that it was hypersensitive, it was appropriately sensitive to a non-stretching stomach. That would be my approach to separating those. But like I say, visceral, this is another thing that we toss around. Visceral sensitivity is tossed around a lot, but we don't normally test for it. We either make it up or we think you have it, and it's kind of tossed around. My big problem with epigastric pain syndrome is, did you investigate all the other causes that pain could be coming from? Just don't blame it on the stomach. Was the gallbladder checked? Here at Wake, we do an ultrasound of the gallbladder to make sure there's no stone or sludge, which are microcrystals, and we do a HIDA scan, which is a gallbladder emptying scan. Gallbladder can also empty too slow or too fast. So, and in some patients, the pain is not particularly on the right side, it's a little more in the middle. If somebody's had their gallbladder removed, I examine very carefully for the scars, the scars that are made by the trocars that are inserted through the abdominal wall. Those scars can become very tender. Those scars can have like neuromas or inflammation in them, and they become an epigastric pain that's sometimes actually worse after people eat, because I think that tender scar can be tugged on from the inside. But if those scars are carefully examined, and we look for what's called a Carnot sign. The doctor puts his finger on these tender spots. By the way, they're usually quite limited. They might be the size of your fingertip. The pain is very local. And sometimes the patients aren't even aware that when they point, their finger is actually resting on one of these tiny scars. When you press on those scars, there can be a pain as much as 7 out of 10. They really hurt. And then you have the patient raise their head up off the table. Some people do like a leg lift, and you see what the pain does. And in patients where the pain is in the scar, that flexing the head off the table, that can ratchet up the pain to a 9 out of 10, a 10 out of 10 in like 3 seconds. And I love to find that, because when that's the case, I say, look, I think your pain is not an epigastric pain syndrome. It is, but look, your pain is actually in that scar. Your pain is in that scar. And I probably send 2 people a week to our pain clinic and say, get rid of the pain in that scar. Now, there may be other issues, no question about it, but that to me is something that I like to find, because it's a pain syndrome that was missed. It's a pain syndrome that can be treated. So if the gallbladder is in, I worry about the gallbladder. If the gallbladder is out, this abdominal wall syndrome, it's called, because the pain is in the wall of the stomach. It's in the wall of the abdomen. It's not the stomach at all. It's the wall of it's the abdominal wall. What else? Maybe some patients with irritable bowel, the pain is more in the epigastrium and can be worse after they eat. So there are some things. Pancreas pain is in the epigastrium. So again, you need to keep an open mind about where, as I said before, what is driving, what's the real driver of the symptoms?
Linda from North Carolina asked, can functional dyspepsia also cause pain in the shoulders as well as the upper abdomen?
Yeah, interesting. Usually if the pain is getting up into the shoulder area, usually right shoulder, back, can even be shoulder blade. I start thinking about gallbladder. You know, if the gallbladder is out, you know, then, you know, I might want to think about, is there kind of some kind of a bile duct problem? So usually when you're getting into the back and the shoulders, that's pretty unusual for just stomach, you know. And we could even say, you know, what we described the previous, you know, over the last half hour are really two kinds of gastric neuromuscular disorder. Gastric neuromuscular disorder A, you actually have delayed emptying. You can't quite empty. And gastric neuromuscular disorder B, you have all the same symptoms, but you have normal emptying. And for rhythm, you may be abnormal or normal. And in our NIH study, it was about 65% of the gastroparetic patients had a bad rhythm, and it was almost the exact same percentage of the FD patients who had a dysrhythmia. And so, interestingly enough, 30%, you know, have a normal rhythm. So when we start to subtype these problems, we can get into a further differential diagnosis. So the point here is, number one, again, the FD and the gastroparesis patients are very similar from their neuromuscular dysfunction. And number two, when you're looking at the stomach, you're not thinking about symptoms related to the shoulder. So I have patients, so I mentioned gallbladder. Gee, I wonder, is there a muscle skeletal component? But yeah, shoulder puts me off to another organ besides gastric neuromuscular dysfunction. Maybe some GERD patients have chest pain. Chest pain might radiate to a shoulder. So any case, I'd look for a different organ that's involved with a lot of shoulder or back pain.
Mary from New York had some questions. Mary, are you on the program here?
Hi, I'm here.
Hi, do you want to ask your question to Dr. Cook?
To be honest, I forgot what I asked. I think it was a week or two ago when I registered. I knew it had something to do with visceral hyperalgesia.
Yeah, so you had asked, is visceral hyperalgesia a common diagnosis in gastroparesis and functional dyspepsia in children? What types of pain relief, et cetera, et cetera?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I mean, I think I kind of put that under the visceral hypersensitivity category, and so if that's usually you're thinking that when you haven't found any better explanation for for instance, a pain or a symptom, you're going to try other things first. You're going to certainly suppress acid, and you know, the PPIs, everybody seems to be on one of these proton pump inhibitors, and they will take care of acid-related symptoms, but they don't help these nerve and muscle-related. It's not going to help a stretch or relaxation issue. It's not going to help a dysrhythmia issue. It's not going to help a pylorus issue. So then you have to move on to your other tests. And here we, you know, we don't have, this is why we're still a difficult area, a frontier, because then what are you going to try? Something, gee whiz, like a Reglan or an erythromycin, or, you know, we don't have that many drugs to stimulate the stomach to empty better. And I probably wouldn't use those. If you had normal emptying, that's not where you'd go. You would go probably to more drugs that are just symptomatic. If there's a lot of nausea, perhaps the Zofrans. Sometimes it's Ativan helps, or the drug that looks like a marijuana molecule called Marinol. So but you're, you know, you're not trying to promote gastric emptying, you know, and even, you know, and even now we know we shouldn't be fixating on the rate of gastric emptying. That really isn't what's driving most of the symptoms, but, you know, for patients still need help with their diets, you know, dietary counseling, because often you still have to eat and you have to kind of know what you're dealing with. So I think it's good to know these physiologic measures so that diet can be tailored perhaps to your stomach accommodation or capacity. And certain foods may be more tolerated than others. We know this for those who have gastroparesis. So, you know, this is where we are, I think, in our thinking right now in terms of the patients with functional dyspepsia and normal emptying. And those who have the same symptoms, they really have functional dyspepsia and delayed emptying. And they can work back and forth. I think that's one message today. And we hope that people with who get labeled functional dyspepsia going forward really should be getting all the different kinds of medications, I believe, that we are trying for our gastroparesis patients. This is happening, but as I said, the paper that's just been published puts this on a nice, on a good physiologic basis.
Well, that kind of goes with the question that Carol from Pennsylvania had posed, and that was, are there any different dietary approaches for gastroparesis versus functional dyspepsia?
Yeah, that's a good question, too, because we know that the patient with functional dyspepsia, at least was about 25%, you know, couldn't really at 8 ounces of drinking 8 ounces of water over 5 minutes, that was all they could handle. They were full, they were nauseated, had some bloating. And so that tells us that there's a decreased accommodation and decreased stretch. Well, there are a few drugs that we could try for that. They tend to be the drugs not well studied at all. By the way, the Bentyl that we use for colonic spasm and IBS, I'll try Bentyl to relax the stomach. It's not specific. There's no drug trial. The NIH is looking at Buspirone, which is an antidepressant, but also can relax the stomach, to see if we can really see a difference in people's ability to tolerate, you know, like a water load. So I think there are some drugs to try to help with those symptoms early after a meal, but the best is just to know that, you know, yeah, I'm filling up right away and I don't feel well right away. And guess what? It's not in my head. This is not something in my head. I've got these studies that show that my stomach doesn't relax. It has small capacity. And until we can find a good drug or a better other treatment, you know, my diet is the key. And I get it. I understand why I'm doing this. I mean, patients figure this out often on their own, but it's helpful, I think, to have, you know, some objective data too. So I do the same diet, basically, whether there's gastroparesis or not in that situation. Those patients who have the sort of poor gastric relaxation.
Julie from Florida had asked, is there an influence on inflammation? Is that a factor with both gastroparesis and a functional dyspepsia?
Yeah. So we really don't know the answer to that. I mean, people will look for H. pylori, you know, for an inflammation in the mucosa, you know, in the lining of the stomach, inflammation in terms of, you know, acid or an infection. In my practice, I just rarely find H. pylori. In other parts of the country, there may be more of this H. pylori that would cause inflammation and these symptoms, but It turns out that the inflammation that we're finding in the stomach is a very chronic and unusual kind of inflammation. It's not about, you know, white blood cells. It's about things that are called macrophages. Macrophages are a very special kind of cell that kind of rest in the tissues. They're there looking for antigens or other something to attack, and it's a very chronic inflammation. And it turns out there are some macrophages that put out, let's call them substances that actually injure ICCs. They're a special kind of macrophage that comes in to do a job, but the collateral damage is to those pacemaker cells. And that's what we're finding in patients with diabetic and idiopathic gastroparesis. It's also just beginning to be looked at in FD. So in that very subtle form, inflammation is a very important aspect, you know, going forward. If we could figure out why those macrophages are coming in and how do you keep them out and have the good macrophages take over. So there's an inflammation story here, but it's still very early and at a cellular basis.
Is Judith from Massachusetts on the call today? No. Well, she was asking if there is an algorithm or protocol for more efficient diagnosis, symptom management, and treatment options.
Yeah.
I guess it's taken her daughter quite a while before she was diagnosed, too. So that's where she's coming from with this question.
Yeah, that's it. And, you know, there still isn't an official algorithm because, you know, it depends on what symptom you're arriving with. You know, if the predominant symptom is epigastric pain, you know, you might go right to endoscopy, even a CT scan of the abdomen, make sure you're not missing anything. It might depend on the age of the patient, gallbladder, you know, as we talked about some of those other items. So it can be, you know, I think initially you have to have a fairly open mind. Maybe everything's being driven by constipation or irritable bowel. As we mentioned there's a lot of organs there in the abdomen. And I often tell the patient, we need to divide and conquer. You need to divide up the organs, test them, and figure out which one is the problem. So it's not a simple, you know, beeline to the diagnosis. You got to be a detective and gather the evidence. And GI tests are, you know, notorious. Sometimes I tell patients, I wish I was an orthopedic doctor. You say, oh, why? Well, because I could send you over to the x-ray machine and I'd get an x-ray of your neck, your shoulder, your back, your hips, you know, in 20 minutes. I've looked at everything. Look at your GI tract. You know, all of our tests are kind of difficult. You have to do multiple. They are probes. They are x-rays. They're endoscopy. So it's not an easy system to make a beeline for. And if you're, you know, and if it's nausea, it may even, you know, say, gee whiz, is your nausea due to your thyroid? Is your nausea, you know, do you have like an inner ear problem? So these are not easy cases sometimes to get to the bottom of, but certainly, for the stomach, I need to see the endoscopy is okay. A properly done 4-hour gastric emptying study. Here at Wake and at some centers, it's the electrogastrogram with a water load study. When I'm scoping, I might biopsy for the H. pylori. So I wish that, yeah, I wish. So they're really not quite there yet so I think it kind of needs to be thorough and more open-minded. And then as you focus down on your abnormal findings, then you've got something to go on, but it tends to be divide and conquer.
Yeah, such a difficult thing. And again, so many patients are going from doctor to doctor and they're getting different diagnoses as well. So it's very difficult on the patients. And oftentimes I've heard from many patients that when they go to a new doctor, they have to take all the tests again. And oftentimes if they're in acute state, they have difficulty going through those tests.
Yeah, so, that's really hard. It's hard to make the change. And it's hard to know when you say, I'm just not getting better. I want to go see somebody else. And because some of the tests are not done 100% properly, or they're not done enough at a site, pretty much the new site may well want their own study. And if somebody says, you know, well, they had this a year ago, and I said, well, yeah, but you're no better. You may be a little worse. So what was done a year ago or even 9 months ago, you know, could be irrelevant to today. And so retesting, unfortunately, is part of the thing. If, you know, an answer's not forthcoming and, you know, other help is sought. The time moves on and, you know, sometimes what wasn't diagnosable a year ago is diagnosable today.
Yeah, now that's a good insight and good way to put it. I'm just going to open this up for a minute to see if anybody else in the audience has a question they would like to ask. And if not, I'll keep going with the written questions. But if you do want to ask Dr. Cook a question, we have a few more minutes. Please state your name and then be mindful if there might be others who want to ask. Would anyone like to ask Dr. Cook a question now?
So I would.
Okay, state your first name and then you can go from there.
My name is Janet. I've had gastroparesis for almost 40 years now. I was diagnosed in 2005 with the GE skin, the 4-hour emptying test.
Uh-huh.
And they told me my stomach was working less than 5%. I mean, I have a stimulator. I have a J-tube. I haven't eaten in 10 years. I'm kind of at my last stage. And I tried to make an appointment with you. And I was wondering if there's any way I could. I don't live in North Carolina. And I really wanted to talk to you because you're like the first doctor that seems to know what he's talking about with this.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. First of all, yeah, that's a long struggle with gastroparesis, and so I'm here in North Carolina, and yeah, so I see a lot of folks from North Carolina and surrounding states, but it's hard when you're sick to go far and then to go through a battery of tests, you know,
right.
As I just kind of mentioned, the talks we had that, you know, depending on the symptoms and because they're so nonspecific, I may end up, you know, really wanting 6 or 7 different diagnostic tests to sort it out. You know, are your ongoing symptoms really due to the stomach or is it something else? You know, and it's very hard. It can range from SIBO to reflux. You know, and all the other organs we've talked about. So
yeah.
Certainly I'm happy to see patients from distances and it's an honor to be, you know, called upon, but it's also very difficult. Some people end up staying some time to get all the tests in. But as you can imagine, because it's not like some, you know, there's not, we don't yet have an efficient way to look at all these different organs that can be dysfunctional, not work right in the GI tract. So,
mm-hmm.
But
yeah,
we're happy to try again if you want to come on down. But do you have any other questions, specific questions for me now?
No, thank you,
Janet. I always say that we want to clone Dr. Cook and put him in all of the areas because he's such a good educator and
yes,
such a good listener. And he he really knows how to communicate with patients in ways that make it easier for the patient to be able to communicate back.
To talk to him, yeah. That's why I was wondering if maybe I could have a phone consult, you know, one-on-one as opposed to some.
Oh, my God. We all would love that. But, of course,
yeah.
The cook is also a very, very busy man.
No, so I know.
It's challenging. I know the wait time for most motility doctors is, what, 2 or 3 months at least. So I can imagine with Dr. Cook. Plus, Dr. Cook, you're doing a lot of research. How you balance all your time, I have no idea. But you're doing so much research on these things. And that's amazing because it's helping so many patients. I know Dr. Cook has another appointment at 12 o'clock. So I'm just going to thank everybody for being here today and for submitting your questions. I'm sorry if we didn't get to all of them. But you can imagine he's in demand. And also, we want to thank you, Dr. Cook, for always.
Yes, thank you.
Your graciousness, your time, and your expertise with our organization and helping so many patients. We're just so thrilled. And to all of you patients and family members, God bless you. You are the quiet heroes who live this every day of your life. Take care. God bless. Thank you again, Dr. Cook.
Well, thank you. No, appreciate it.
Thank you, doctor.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.